Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon for those of you on the East Coast, and good morning for you on those on the West Coast. Special edition of the 40 Teams Fire American Soccer Show, as we're going to talk about Sunil Gulati, as he has decided not to seek re-election as president of U.S. Soccer. That means the doors are wide open to see who is going to take over. Joining me right now is one of the top soccer reporters in this country, and of course that is Miss Andrea Canales, who's joining me right now, waiting for Carter Kirshner of World Soccer Talk to join us. And Andrea, thank you for coming on, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Big news yesterday, of course, broken by ESPN and other news outlets, that Sunil Gulati will not seek re-election as president of U.S. soccer due to the fact of what happened with the national team not qualifying for the World Cup next summer in Russia. How big of a significance is it that Gulati, while he did take his time, he decided not to, or he made this decision to not seek re-election?
I think it's hugely significant, and because he's been president for 12 years, and he ran unopposed most of those re-election terms, and it's basically been Gulati as a figure sort of looming over U.S. soccer, and his vision has been really helpful to the game in some ways, and yet it's been so singular. He's had, in that sense, for an unpaid position, so much control. I actually think the presidency is going to change more from how the board is now making moves to make it more of a collaboration. It's not going to be as unilaterally powerful as it was during Sunil's day. So it's basically kind of like the end of an era, sort of like when President Delano Roosevelt, he was like all these consecutive terms, and then they put in term limits. And that changed the presidency forever, because now, 8 years is the max. It's sort of like that, in the sense that the presidency is never going to be the same with the end of the era of Sunil, basically.
Mm-hmm. And Carter Kirshner from World Soccer Talk now joins us. And Carter, with all the good that Sunil Gulati has done, we can't ignore that, but still, there seems to be always something negative when you are in that high power running the game in this country as president of U.S. soccer. In your mind, like what Andrea just said, I mean, where do you think so far his legacy is going to be at this point in time?
Well, first off, Daniel, it's great to be with you. Great to be with Andrea. And I want to concur with what she said. I've likened Sunil Gulati to being the imperial president, right? He's done a lot of things unilaterally. He's done a lot of things by himself, without board approval or taking his board along kicking and screaming. I can tell you, for example, even the ongoing situation that obviously we've talked a lot about on your shows in the past when I've come on, NASL litigation against U.S. soccer, the antitrust lawsuit, and previously even sanctioning a second division with USL and NASL. A lot of it involved Gulati and the pro council, led by Don Garber, an MLS commissioner, acting out of accord with, not necessarily out of accord with the board, but not in direct consultation with the board of governors. And obviously when there was something important that would happen, like the sanctioning decisions, Sunil Gulati would go to his board and have them ratify or rubber stamp what had been done. But I think what I have observed in the last 2 months since the Trinidad and Tobago game, we talked a lot about on the pitch, on the field issues, Daniel, but what I've noticed off the pitch from talking to people in and around U.S. soccer is perhaps a little bit of an attempt by those on the board, including Carlos Cordero, who's running for president, to take some of that power back, to make decisions at the board level at U.S. Soccer more based more on consensus and based more on diversities of opinions that might be aired in the boardroom than Sunil or Don Garber, who are very, very close allies, of course, dictating things. So the question is, are we going to go in that direction where the Imperial presidency is no more and we're in a more consensus-oriented, board-driven, or even state association-driven U.S. soccer landscape? Or are we in a situation where and I have to get the door for a minute, so I'll let you
sure.
Turn this over to Andrea. Thanks.
Well, sure, of course. And Andrea, I just have to say that while, you know, there's been, I guess, secrecy going around at times, we've seen Sunil Gulati keep things close to the vest. And, you know, while we are grateful for some of the financial things he has done to make U.S. soccer, you know, not be, you know, looking, I don't want to say a handout or anything like that, but, you know, he has made the Federation profitable all over the place. But still, though, when it came to what was going on, you know, on the field, obviously not qualifying for two consecutive Olympics, there was a couple of three and outs in the under 17 World Cups. There, of course, now this basically took the cake, not qualifying for the big World Cup for next summer. I mean, is there going to be a positive negative reaction here about what Gulati has done for the national, for the Federation?
I think in the light of the failure of the U.S. soccer team, the men's U.S. soccer team, to qualify, it's definitely going to leave a stain on Gulati's legacy. In fact, I think that he won't really be appreciated for the positive things that he did. In a certain way, money's not really glamorous. You know, people don't like to talk about, mm-hmm. for example, how the U.S. is the wealthiest country to participate in the World Cup or any elements like that. It's not even. I mean, certain soccer club teams around the world sometimes tout how much money they make, but they usually build the personality, the team, and the players, and everybody loves the underdog story. So when you say the financial underpinnings, it's concrete, it's measurable, it's very much attributable to, I mean, let's not forget Sunil's day job is an economics professor. He's going to be good at looking at numbers, and he definitely has been good at producing numbers for U.S. soccer. But, you know, the passion of sport is not in financial numbers per se. And I don't think that'll be appreciated by a lot of people who, you know, forget the days in which the U.S. Soccer team had, you know, Sunil, like, helping out by doing the team laundry and stuff like that. The down and dirty, gritty days that are so far in the past that many of the current fans don't even think about it or, you know, remember it. I mean, I still laugh because I can not personally recall, but I remember being aware of, like, one U.S. soccer qualifying match in which they pulled a spectator down from the stands to play for the U.S. team. Stories that people forget. Yeah. I mean, like, what other soccer team around the world has had to do that before? And so the U.S. Soccer team has come a long way from those days, but not qualifying for the U.S. The U.S. not qualifying for the World Cup is going to be what people remember in the present here and now. And I think that will be appreciated, you know, later on as, like, historians take an overall look at the big picture and they see, oh, this is when we really turned around and became a more professionally run organization. This is when we started to actually have a profit. This is when we looked at how to fund development things because we actually had the money to fund them. And the argument that begins now about development can happen because the money is there. And people can, you know, slam Sunil for spending the money in the right or wrong places, but it can't really be argued that without him, perhaps there wouldn't even be that money to argue about.
Let me ask you this, and we'll wait for Carr to come back. I'm assuming he's back, but let me ask you this anyway. When the pick – okay, good. Well, then Then let me ask you this, Kartik. Obviously, the biggest moment of this whole situation, fiasco, whatever you want to say, is him down in Trinidad in the press conference room of that little stadium, of Sunil Gulati basically slumping in his chair and having a very negative look on his face, because in my view, this will be to me, that picture is going to last forever and ever now, because as Andrea has already stated, this failure to qualify for the World Cup will be a part of his legacy forever and ever and ever.
Yeah, certainly I think there is a lot of blame to go around behind Sunil Gulati, who has turned, as I think Andrea has just very articulately argued, into an important position from managing the finances. And the business of football, business of soccer, if you will, is still in its adolescence globally. It's not as evolved as a business as some of the American sports, American college sports especially, which even though football is the world's game, it wasn't treated seriously as a business consideration, I think, until Joao Havelange became the president of FIFA. And until we began seeing some of the things at the domestic league levels, Mexico, Televisa's interest, television-driven things. England, certainly the Premier League breaking away from the Football League. Again, television pushed by Sky to do that in 1992. I think the business of football is still very young. So we might look back years from now on Sunil Gulati and have a different appreciation for the fact that he was able to create a sustainable business out of the U.S. Soccer Federation when, as Andrea mentioned, it wasn't prior to that. However, in the short term, I think most people are focusing on several issues. One, obviously, first and foremost, the failure of the U.S. qualified for the 2018 FIFA World Cup. I'd say secondly, the continued, I think, even though it's been solved with a better CBA this go-around, the continued, problems in the women's game in terms of equal pay, in terms of equal marketing for the women's national team versus the men's national team. Women's national team a whole lot more successful on the global stage than the men's national team. And then I would also mention that there have been some concerns about the way NWSL, which is a more directly tied league to U.S. soccer, has operated and run. And thirdly, obviously, the situation we have that we've talked about extensively on this show between USL and NASL at the D2 level of the men's game. So these three things kind of thrown in a mixture together in 2016 and 2017 really hastened the end of Sunil Gulati's tenure. Even though he solved the women's national team problem with a new CBA, there was a public black eye, and it was unfortunate because, as Sunil Gulati had stated, the U.S. was a trailblazer in the women's game and was maybe the first major federation in a Western nation to put the women's game on a pedestal equal to the men. But as time has moved on, you've seen other countries, particularly in Western Europe, Germany, France, England, the Netherlands, begin to take women's football very, very seriously at the club level and at the international level, to a point where now it seems like we're treading water in that. So that was something that, even though he was able to negotiate a new CBA, which was satisfactory to most parties, that's still lingering out there. And then, of course, overall, the whole the failure of the men's national team, I guess, trumps all, right? Those other two topics I've mentioned have created dissent against Gulati, but I don't think ultimately led to his ouster or his decision not to seek re-election. It was that failure of the men's national team to qualify for the World Cup.
Andrea, obviously, you know, any other federation, any other football, soccer federation in the world, when we saw when Italy did not qualify for the World Cup, obviously, the manager of the national team, as well as the president of the federation, has either quickly resigned or has given maybe 2 or 3 days to say, okay, that's it, I'm done, I'm going to resign, and it's over. I mean, Gulati took his time here. And I know Bruce Arena, that's a different story, obviously. I mean, it took him like 2 or 3 days to say that I'm not going to stay for 2018 for the friendlies and whatever, but was it a little unusual to see Sunil Gulati take this long to make this decision that he decides not to seek re-election? Or did you just think maybe, okay, look, we do it a little differently here, and it doesn't matter, he's finally done it?
I do think it goes to how the position is different. In many cases, the president of the federation is focused so much on the team that basically that's their only remit, to that the men's national team of that country do well. And so if there is such a failure, like failure to qualify, then that's expected in that country's culture and whatnot. But as has been pointed out already, we have a U.S. women's national team that Sunil just finished the CBA on. There's a lot of other things under his purview, including, of course, the upcoming World Cup bid that Sunil is basically in charge of. I mean, Mexico and Canada are sort of riding on the U.S.'s wake there. So it would be, with him putting so much work into it, kind of a weird immediate resignation. It would kind of be leaving, U.S. soccer holding the bag on some of that stuff organizationally. And one thing to point out, as he doesn't seek re-election, he's also not stepping down from that organizational aspect. So there's a very real possibility that the legacy of Sunil Gulati, which we've been discussing already, will be redeemed sooner than some people expect if that bid is successful and if that World Cup goes well, because people will, presumably see the benefit of all the work that he's put into that and not be left with that image that you so powerfully mentioned about when the team lost against Trinidad. And I mean, that's just that possibility that exists. Then the other aspect of it is, just the way the cycle works. There was still time because, whether or not he resigns immediately, if he's not seeking re-election, then anything that is coming up, it's not the same schedule as the rest of the world in terms of, or as a lot of the rest of the world in terms of the competitions that are considered major, as in, the Euros. Obviously, there's the Gold Cup, but it's not on the same level as those sort of international competitions. It's sort of World Cup or nothing. So in the aftermath of it, there's kind of a lull in which, not resigning or not saying that he wasn't going to run again doesn't necessarily disrupt anything that's going on in terms of planning. Now, we don't have a coach other than, Dave Sarakan for interim for the U.S. men's national team. And yet no one's really panicking because there's nothing coming up for the men since they're out of the World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, the Gold Cup is once every 2 years, unfortunately. And I think hopefully down the road they'll make it once every 4 years, because I just don't think the biannual Gold Cup would be feasible for CONCACAF, but once again, that's another show for another time. But yeah, like Andrea said, Kartik, there's not much pressure, on the U.S. Soccer Federation president to quickly say, look, this is all on my watch, and effective immediately, I'm going to go and resign. I mean, we've seen that, like you've said many times on past shows. Roy Hodgson did it after they got eliminated from the Euros, after the embarrassing loss in their minds to Iceland, which of course was fantastic to see them do a miracle thing, but still, what happened with the Italian national team? They didn't qualify for the World Cup after crashing out of the playoff against Sweden. So, what other things need to change here to truly put pressure on our federation and those that are a part of it to try and, you might say more accountability possibly?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is we've kind of divulged into camps, much like our domestic politics, quite frankly. So it's not any indifferent than what's happening in American society, where you've got a very hardcore group that will support Major League Soccer, support essentially anything Major League Soccer does, although that's been a little bit tried by the Columbus situation, but supports Major League Soccer, supports U.S. Soccer, and believes that we've made great strides in this sport, and without the structure put in place by U.S. Soccer, Major League Soccer, Soccer United Marketing, we would not have professional soccer in this country. I happen to believe that is true to a point, and it was true until maybe 8 years ago. But now the sport, particularly the sport from Europe and from Mexico, is more popular domestically, the club game in Liga MX and in Premier League coming from England are more popular domestically than Major League Soccer. Then you have another camp that is maybe just extreme in their view, as extreme in their viewpoint, which says we have to have promotion and relegation. We have to blow up the entire youth pay-to-play system. All of the grievances that NASL has against U.S. soccer are legitimate and are based on an artificial monopoly which violates antitrust laws created by U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer, not owing anything to the fact that NASL, and I can speak to this as a former NASL employee, has made countless mistakes on their own. Now, I think there are certainly many reasons why they're in the position they're in, which are due to Sunil Gulati and Don Garber. There are also just as many reasons they're in this situation that they're in due to self-inflicted errors and taking some of the wrong owners on. Into their league. But so there are these two opposite camps, Daniel, which is the point. And there's really very little moderating voice in the middle. And then when you get guys who are responsible journalists who are trying to account for both sides, trying to balance these considerations against each other, a guy like a Bo Durr, for instance, he ends up getting shot at by both sides, right? I'm just using him as an example.
Yep.
So I think this is the problem. We can't – having the mature conversation, and I've dealt with it. I mean, people tend to associate me more with the latter camp because I work for NASL. But then when I make critiques of NASL and I make critiques, which I've done often on your show, the next day Twitter has exploded with all this abuse towards me. So it's something where I'm not sure we're – prepared necessarily to have the mature conversation. And so the questions that need to be asked, the level of accountability that needs to be put in place towards U.S. soccer is often being articulated by people who are malcontents and who are not tolerant of anything that is going on in the system, and therefore their credibility is damaged. Now, and then on the flip side, the people who defend the system and defend everything U.S. soccer does tend to be company men, for lack of a better term, company men and women. So there has to be some sort of moderating influence here. Let's hope we get the leadership and the accountability from someone running for U.S. soccer president. Real quickly before you turned over to Andrea, I do like a lot of what I'm hearing from a number of the candidates. Again, people have just made an assumption about me personally that I must be backing Eric Winnall, but that's not the case. I'm very open to what I hear from all the candidates. And obviously, I like Waldo and have a closer personal relationship with him than anyone else running. But I haven't made an endorsement. But I like a lot of what you're hearing from just about every candidate, from Carlos Cordero all the way through to Waldo. I haven't heard from Kathy Carter yet, but it will be interesting to see how she contrasts her vision and her feelings about the sport from Sunil Gulati and the status quo.
Yeah, we'll get
what
to that in a
minute.
What I think
is kind of interesting.
Go ahead. Yep. No, that's all right. I was going to say the next, but you can go ahead, Andrew.
We talked a little bit about, Sunil Gulati's unilateral power and how that may never be the same. But I think those who will miss that the most are actually those who are most opposed to Sunil Gulati. In other words, they want the same kind of unilateral power, but for a candidate that shares their views. And they're not going to be happy with a structure that is more collaborative with the board, because on the board there's a lot of competing elements. And it's not going to be, because some of the voices crying loudest for change want that change imposed on U.S. soccer, want MLS and the lower leagues to be told how to structure themselves, and want the youth clubs in development to be told how to structure themselves. And And their idea is that Sunil was allowed to do it for all these years, and his plan didn't work out so well. Now it's our turn. We should be able to go in and impose, you know, just as much, just in a different direction. So it's really going to be interesting to see how some of that plays out, because we have to keep in mind that what the candidates are saying isn't necessarily what's going to be able to, politically it goes into the structure of how do you see the federation structured. Is it going to be that imperial structure, or is it going to be more democratic? Because democracy is sometimes really messy. It's a lot of people arguing back and forth. And sometimes it means that things don't get done, or things get done kind of halfway, or in this, you know, in this kind of haphazard, I don't want to say haphazard because that's a negative connotation, but definitely not to the extremes that some people who want change to happen would like. It's not as blanket or complete a change. It's incremental change. And some people think that that's precisely the problem, that that, you know, U.S. soccer needs to have extreme change. And in that sense, they're actually advocating for the continuation of the imperial reign, just with, you know, somebody else in charge, rather than Sunil.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Daniel, yeah. Let me echo what Andreas said.
Go ahead.
Absolutely 100% correct. That's the thing that I found to be very hypocritical about some of the people who are in the latter camp I mentioned a minute ago, that they complain about what they think is unilateral decision-making by Sunil Gulati and by the powers that be in U.S. soccer, that be it Gulati or Don Garber or Mark Abbott or whoever, and not taking things to the board, not taking things to the pro council, not taking things to the youth council or the athletes council, et cetera. That is correct, and I share their critiques. However, their remedy would be to do the same thing just with their own person and in their own manner. So I completely agree with what Andrea is saying. Very, very important for people to understand as they evaluate this presidential race and the critiques that are being made by either side. I think if you go to a more consensus-oriented process of decision-making and structuring things, which inevitably is probably what happens because of the imperial presidency of Gulati and et cetera, things might happen a lot slower. They might happen to a point where 100% of the people are happy 25% of the time or 50% of the time, but not 100% of the time. And given the polarization in our soccer community, which reflects, as I said, American society in general, perhaps that's not going to be satisfactory to everyone. However, for me, I think that's where we need to go, because as I've said, while people often associate me with the latter camp, I have some definite alliances or thoughts that mirror that of people in the former camp. So I think a consensus-based approach would be good, but as Andrea points out, I think a lot of people are not going to be happy with how slow things move and how that turns out. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll definitely see on that one. And all I can say is that right now things are going to change as Sunil Gulati once again will not seek re-election for president of U.S. Soccer. And that means we've got everything's wide open here, guys. Everything is wide open depending on, you know, who the candidates are, what they're going to do. And if we let's go ahead and discuss the candidates right now that are looking to take over as president of U.S. Soccer. Let us go, of course, right away to Miss Kathy Carter. I have her Twitter page up in front of me. Apparently, this is what she put on Twitter 5 hours ago. She's excited to announce her candidacy for president of U.S. Soccer. Soccer can and should become the leading sport in America, and I intend to make that vision a reality. Thrilled for you to get to know me and my vision for the game. She has played the game as an executive and avid fan of the game for more than 40 years. She is running, of course, for U.S. Soccer Federation presidency, and of course, she was a part of running Soccer United Marketing, some, of course, that everyone knows. Andrea, do you know her I'm not saying personally, but do you know of her very well and what she has done for bringing soccer over, you know, for these big time matches as a head of some? Do you feel she's a viable candidate? Does she actually pique your interest?
Sure, she does. Partly because I can't vote for you. I mean, it's sort of like watching it's watching what goes on almost in a country that maybe you have ties to, but you can't actually vote in their election. And it's sort of like that. I'm definitely an interested observer, but I can't personally vote for U.S. soccer president. It's kind of an interesting structure. Mm-hmm. People should read up on exactly who can vote and all the the various influences and that might be something that can also change in the future, because some would say the U.S. soccer version of an electoral college is not a fair one. The voices that should be affecting the choice aren't really getting heard. But that aside, I'm definitely intrigued by Kathy, and not just because she's the only female candidate in history, but also because of, as you mentioned, that long experience. And yet at the same time, she is practically unknown. And because I've worked with or I've covered events that some has run for a long time, and I realize in that context that there's been certain things that I'm sure we were at together, and yet, you know, I never saw occasion to speak to her. If she went anywhere, for example, with like Sunil, we would probably stop and speak to Sunil or, you know, somebody else. But, you know, at least it never occurred to me I should interview the president of Soccer United Marketing. In hindsight, I wish I had, so that I had more than a passing knowledge of how some runs events. I know that it's popular in some corners for people to look at some as some sort of, you know, corporate evil entity. But in my experience, the fact that, you know, that there wasn't, I mean, because there was a sort of a wild west for promotional events in soccer in the U.S., and a lot of them were run badly, that people would, you know, take the money and then, you know, deliver a really haphazard product. That there were some events I covered when I was a stringer for AP, a couple of international teams that were, it was just like almost scary to be at. It's just like, what is going on? And that was me as a reporter. I don't even want to imagine how maybe some fans or some people with young kids might have felt in those contexts. And for better or worse, and I do recognize that there are some negative elements to shutting out maybe fledgling promoters and whatnot, and having one company run almost all the major soccer events in the country. It really did just bring it together in a way that was organized and efficient and profitable for U.S. soccer. And not just for the separate venues, and it was the sort of thing that actually allowed, because when the venues felt that they could have an international soccer match, for example, and the stadium would not be trashed, then they were more likely to say, okay, we'd love to host another soccer event, as opposed to saying, forget it, you know, your organizers, your promoters, you guys don't know what you're doing, you don't know how to run an event and, like, leave a place, you know, in decent shape. Just like little things like that, and people think, oh, you know, it's just a big capitalist entity and stifling the little guy. Well, I mean, if soccer events can't come and be good guests at venues, then, you know, that actually stifles the game in the U.S. because then you can't invite other teams and you can't convince venues to host them. So that level of professionalism and that level of efficiency, I actually think it's very much to her benefit that she's quietly been running this, and it's done so well on that count. People may argue for more transparency, and I think that that's valid, but one thing you definitely can't argue about is how well they have done their job of marketing and running and putting on these international soccer events. That's part of the reason why it's such a viable thing to say that the U.S. can host a World Cup again, because they've been running successfully all these soccer events for so many years.
Yeah, I agree with you about that, Andrea. It's amazing, though, Kardec, that and I personally have never heard of her myself until, you posted about her running on Twitter. MLS is, supporting her in her run as, in this election for U.S. soccer president. And it's one of those things where she is an unknown, from some people. And do you think she has an advantage right now? Or do you think because, well, sadly, we've seen some already outrage because she is a part of MLS, whether you like it or not, because she does run Soccer United Marketing at this point in time, I should say.
Yeah, let me agree with the analysis there about covering events in this country. I'll tell you, even to this day, if an event is done by another match promoter other than Soccer United Marketing, or quite frankly, relevant now with Charlie running that entity, they've upped their game, and they're very comparable in their presentation and the way they handle media and the way they handle fans to some. But if it's not one of those two entities, and there are a lot of games still out there that aren't one of those two entities that I've had to cover the last few years, or work even, it's still very dodgy. It's still not at the level of professionalism you would expect as media or as a fan, and it creates a bad image of this sport with journalists who are not people who typically cover our sport. And a lot of times when we have these international friendlies between big club teams coming from Europe or from South America or Mexico or wherever, and they're not, and you get a lot of casual media. I know that here in Florida, that if you get a match between, for example, we had a match between Shakhtar Donetsk and Schalke a few years ago, and you get media that would normally not cover the sport because these are two Champions League teams. These are two teams they can see on UEFA Champions League. They're average journalist who covers NFL or Major League Baseball is more aware of the UEFA Champions League than they are of MLS, sadly, but that's the reality. So there's a club they recognize, they'll show up, and the presentation, the way the events are handled are in many cases so poor and so unprofessional and so not at a level that journalists are used to dealing with the professional sports or the college sports they cover in this country, that they don't come back. And it creates a very bad image about the sport. So I concur on that. In terms of her level of support, we still have to gauge that. My view is that she probably wouldn't run and offer herself in this position if she didn't feel like she could win. Major League Soccer controls 57% of the pro council. USL and NWSL have between them 39%, I believe. So she probably goes in with the 22 or 23% of the pro council behind her. I'm sure some state soccer associations would be amenable to her. I'm sure that there are people on the athletes council who are amenable to her, although my understanding is there are some that are open to Kyle Martino and Eric Rinaldo as well. We'll obviously talk about those candidacies in a few minutes. The U.S. Soccer Board, the sitting board, you hear conflicting things. People don't want to speak on the record to many of us. But the things I've heard, it seems like there is a real impetus among at least some of the board members for Carlos Cordero, his financial The two pieces of his candidacy are his financial acumen, coming from Goldman Sachs and being a leading member of the U.S. Soccer Board, and also his perceived independence from Soccer United Marketing and MLS, and maybe his more his greater interest in securing the financial health of U.S. soccer as an independent entity, first and foremost, versus commingling with MLS. So that's the consideration there. But I think she has a very good chance of getting elected. I don't want to say she's a runaway favorite, but I think she probably is the favorite at this point. And we'll know better in a week once nominations and qualifying is completed and we realize who exactly the candidates are and where their support, at least to get themselves to that stage, has come from.
And now let's go to the ones that we already know that are wanting to run, and of course we'll go straight to it. Eric Winalda, former U.S. International striker. He has been very vocal about wanting to change the culture of U.S. soccer, and of course now a former Fox Sports analyst on soccer for the Bundesliga coverage. And one person that who has played this game for a long time, obviously, Andrea. What are the pros and cons about Eric so far that makes you think either he is suitable or not?
Eric is, if you're looking at the position of U.S. soccer president as a figurehead that is going to spark a lot of attention and both positive and negative and really get a discussion and debate going on how to change things in U.S. soccer culture, then I think just the attention that Eric has garnered with his candidacy alone is notable. He definitely has the credentials as a player. Who remembers some of those dark days of soccer, by the way? Because Eric was definitely one of the pioneers who was part of the team that got the U.S. To qualify for the World Cup in Italy in 1990. And I think in some ways, the negative side of Eric is also encapsulated in that red card he got in 1990, because which still might remain the most notable accomplishment of that 1990 team, other than arriving in Italy. And people will remember that because Eric is a passionate player, a passionate person, and that passion, as part of U.S. soccer, can be a spark to get a lot of things going, can perhaps spark a movement. Eric has been vocal in his support for a lot of things that people argue will really change the U.S. soccer landscape, such as promotion or relegation. And I think that those are discussions that some people are really excited about, even if they won't necessarily come into fruition very quickly. So from that point of view, if you want somebody in charge of U.S. soccer who is going to command a lot of attention and be willing to court controversy and pick some opinions that will shake up the establishment, then I think Eric's candidacy is very valid. And that being said, there's a lot of negatives associated with that too. And I definitely think that Eric is probably number one for those who would, as I mentioned before, like continuation of the imperialistic power, because as much as he's able to gain supporters, Eric also tends to alienate people. And if U.S. soccer as an organization is moving toward a more collaborative organization, and more transparency among how the board works with the president and not just there as a sort of final rubber stamp to really come forward and be transparent with what their motivation and their aims are. Because I think a lot of it is that people don't understand perhaps what the different factions of U.S. soccer want. And if they get more involved and the setup is such that they have to and they have to make their voices known and put their votes forward on certain issues in a public way, then people are going to know, oh, it was the pro players who voted this. It was the youth club organizations that voted this. Right now, a lot of that we don't really know. And so we don't really know who's pulling which way. We just know that there's a final decision made. And it could be a rubber stamp. It could be exactly what these different groups wanted. And so in that sense, I think Eric is kind of very individualistic and maybe not the best person to work well with others in a group that is trying to build consensus. So that's kind of my view, positive and negative on the matter.
No, that's fine. You know, look, all views are welcome. You know, it's an open discussion. You know, we got to see what are the pros and the cons of these candidates. And Kardec, if I can ask you that question about Eric Winalda, and you know him well, and I've had Eric on this show in the past, of course, and he's a great guy. Can he play with others? I think that's the number one question right now with Eric Winalda. If he does win it, can he play with others?
Yeah, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm very friendly with Eric. I think a lot of people know that. I speak to him regularly. I've spoken to him in the last few days. So I'm remaining objective about his candidacy, but I do have a personal friendship with him, which I don't have with anyone else running, and a personal relationship and a professional relationship. I've worked with him in the past. So just get that out there. I think it goes both ways. There are people who have told me they're kind of impressed by Winalda's willingness to listen and engage people in this candidate in this campaign, because they're used to the very impulsive Eric, the very opinionated Eric. That having been said, it is pretty obvious that his views on a number of issues related to the sport in this country are pretty inflexible, right? And if we're talking about having a board-driven, consensus-driven future for U.S. soccer, Eric's management style would probably be more similar to Sunil Gulati's, even though obviously his ideology, his views on the sport from everything from pay-to-play to promotion and relegation to the calendar and wanting to align the U.S. The U.S.'s pro leagues with the international calendar, with the particularly with European leagues to align transfer windows and that sort of thing, are radically different than those of Sunil Gulati and the powers that be. But his management style would probably be very similar. So can he listen? Yes. He, as I said, people have told me they're impressed. They're surprised that he's listening more and engaging people more in this campaign. But I do know him really well, as you mentioned, and I know his personality. His management style, he's one of individualism, as has been mentioned, and also I think is one of somewhat of a rigid ideology, a very strong opinions that probably are not fostered based on consensus. That having all been said, there is so much dissatisfaction, it seems, at the grassroots level right now with U.S. soccer because of the culmination of the three things I mentioned earlier, especially the U.S. non-qualification for the World Cup, but also the women's national team CBA fiasco, even though it eventually got resolved, and the Division II situation. Oh, and I also have to throw in there the CAS claim against U.S. soccer regarding pay-to-play and Crossfire Premier, the old the former youth club of DeAndre Yedlin in the Seattle area. All of these elements have come together to create a real platform for Eric Winalda, and the people who tend to be most concerned about those issues are very gradually gravitating towards him. I'm seeing state soccer associations supporting him. I'm hearing of amateur leagues, small amateur regional leagues in this country trying to corral their owners to make public endorsements of Winalda. I'm also hearing a lot of some youth clubs stepping out, who want to see solidarity payments, want to see that sort of thing happening, stepping out and supporting him. So what you have is a kind of a broader coalition of people who are dissatisfied with the direction of things coming together behind him. Now, what would become challenging for him if he were to get elected is We've already mentioned he's very individualistic. He's fairly impulsive. How does he satisfy all these constituencies? Because they all have a common enemy right now, if you will. Enemy is a strong word, but a common opponent in Sunil Gulati and the U.S. soccer status quo. But their interests aren't necessarily the same. They're not necessarily aligned. They're divergent groups, from the pro-rel folks to the amateur leagues to the youth clubs to the NASL people, most of those groups I mentioned, have an overwhelming majority of their stakeholders, if you will, supporting Winalda at this point.
Paul LaPointe, obviously, a very, very vocal person as well, as coming from one of the lower levels of American soccer in the UPSL over at the he's the Northeast Conference manager, Andrea. Same thing. Do you think he would be if he is to be voted on and wins it, do you think he'd be a solid candidate for president as well?
Well, he's definitely not as the mm-hmm. Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh.
I throw you a curveball. I'm sorry.
No. I wanted to say that, you know, he's not as sexy a choice as Winalda, you know, with his fiery personality, or Carter, who, as quiet as she is a pioneer, you know, especially by virtue of being a female candidate, or, you know, some of the other candidates who we have yet to mention who are former players. So, the reason I laughed is because I didn't want, you know, the idea of, like, a sexy candidate to be taken the wrong way. Maybe a better word is glamorous, you know? It's not as glamorous of a candidate. But I was sort of blanking on another word to use. Anyway, actually, as far as, you know, once again, depth of experience, and especially in the kind of soccer that is under the radar for many people in the United States, but is a huge underpinning in terms of all the years he has with lower league levels, and, you know, even as a former pro, and many people don't realize that when U.S. soccer was practically off the grid, that it was the indoor game that people could still go to and cheer for teams, and kind of kept like a spark of soccer alive when in the interim between the original NASL and the arrival of MLS in 1996. So, you know, once again, somebody with that sense of U.S. soccer history and how far it's come, and who has been a part of helping it bring it that way in that sort of lower layer of soccer, that's where LaPointe has a lot of his experience. And I, for one, respect that, value that. But once again, I also recognize that it's not glamorous. And it's not it may not, you know, fulfill what a lot of people want right now. Like as Kartik said, they're really hungry for change. And for some of them, you know, Paul just doesn't represent drastic enough change.
And Kartik, your opinion about Mr. LaPointe?
Yeah, I know him. I don't know him very well. Obviously, I don't know him as well as I know Eric Winalda, but I've had some conversations with him through the years, and I think he's a pretty good administrator with a lot of ideas and historical perspective about the game in this country, as has been mentioned. So I think from my perspective, it would be important for whoever wins, and it probably won't be him, to include him and people like him who've been involved in UPSL, who've been involved in NPSL, lower divisions, amateur soccer, even the indoor game, even the amateur women's game, which we've seen go through a lot of ebbs and flows. The USLW League has disappeared. I'm told, maybe I'm speaking out of school here, but I've been told by someone at USL that they might have a women's league again in the near future. But for now, you're dealing with WPSL, which is kind of on a weak footing. So having someone in a high-ranking position in U.S. soccer who has a seat at the table, who represents those interests and has that perspective, is so important. And I can't stress that enough. And I think even though Paul LaPointe is probably not going to win this race, there is an important seat at the table for someone like him. And as we go towards a more board-driven, consensus-driven approach, if that's the direction we in fact go, I think his voice will be heard. And if Eric Winalder were to win, I think his voice would probably be heard as well, because his opinions happen to mirror many of Winalder's opinions. As Andrea mentions, yeah, Winalder has a certain spark and personality and nature to him that makes people gravitate to him instead of Paul LaPointe, even though a lot of what Paul LaPointe says mirrors what Eric Winalda's saying, but he just doesn't have that gravitas, if you will, if that's the word you're looking for.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah.
Last one. Yeah, absolutely. Last candidate, obviously, and then we'll probably wrap it up with that. Kyle Martino, former player for the Galaxy and the Columbus Crew, of course, doing TV for NBC Sports Network's coverage of the English Premier League. He just, you know, was very upset as well when he was talking about the United States being eliminated from the World Cup on set down in Stamford, Connecticut. And now, of course, he's on hiatus with NBC because he's going to try and run for U.S. soccer presidency. In your opinion, Andrea, what are the pros and cons about Kyle Martino that you believe about his run?
Well, Kyle Martino, I covered as a reporter back when he played in Major League Soccer, and especially, you know, during the last of his career out here in L.A., with the L.A. Galaxy, which coincided with, you know, the arrival of David Beckham. And so, I mean, Kyle was always one of the most articulate players if you wanted to, you know, have a very thoughtful perspective on things. And I think the things that he said since declaring his candidacy and his reasons for it and the fact that he walked away from a pretty amazing job in which he was you know, pretty well respected for a relative outsider to the EPL, because it's not like he had gone there and played. I mean, there's a few U.S. men's soccer team players who have done stints in England, but Kyle really didn't. And yet, you know, because of that perspective and his ability to articulate his thoughts well, I think he had been doing well as a commentator in a gig that's kind of setting himself up as a big target. You know, the Americans speaking on the English Premier League is sort of ripe for mocking, and he earned respect despite that vulnerability. And, you know, so the sincerity to leave that sort of job and to run for U.S. soccer is something that I respect, and I think a lot of people it caught their attention, and he is, I think, the youngest candidate in the field, if I'm not mistaken, by quite a bit, at least in terms of, you know, generally. And I think he brings that perspective of a new generation of soccer fans. Like, for example, a lot of the ones which I was talking to, some of the fans that I was chatting with on social media, after the disappointment of the U.S. not qualifying, I realized they weren't alive when the last time the U.S. failed to make the World Cup, and they sort of had taken it for granted that it would always happen, and you know, the idea that even going to the World Cup was anything special, it was you know, we need to set our sights higher. How do we win the World Cup? You know, and it was so taken for granted that I honestly think that was part of the shock about not qualifying, is that people had taken it completely for granted, and in fact were agitating with the federation and upset that there wasn't a better plan and more steps concrete taken in their view to win the World Cup. Well, obviously you can't win it if you're not there. And even though to a certain extent, I think it's, the height of hubris to think that, oh, it can't happen to us. I mean, You have Italy, which has won the World Cup, not making it. You have, you know, other teams that are very good, that the Dutch and out of, you know, South America, every qualifying, there's a few deserving teams that you just know could shake things up at the World Cup that don't make it to the tournament because qualifying out of their group is so hard. So to me, people speak about U.S. soccer arrogance, the fan arrogance to assume, oh, we're always going to be there. You know, I mean, Mexico almost didn't make it last cycle, but no, we're always going to be there. I think that's the height of hubris because sporting competition means that everybody's vulnerable. Any team can lose, and the worst-case scenarios can and will happen. That aside, I think Kyle Martino is sort of that voice for that younger generation of fans, and he's able to not only articulate that voice, but I also think that he has shown a sort of political deftness in which he can speak to different elements. If we're talking about, you know, a candidate that can build good consensus, that can listen to different sides of something, I think that that he's actually one of the appealing ones.
Kardik?
Yeah, let me agree with all of that and also say, I mean, I've woken up with Kyle Martino now for 5 years on Saturday and Sunday mornings, his coverage of the Premier League. The word trailblazer is not used enough to describe him because I have to tell you, when you deal with fans of the Premier League, and I deal with them, with my accent, I have gotten so many, oh, Yank, shut up type comments, and I've covered the Premier League now for over a decade. And as you know, Daniel, you've seen me exposed to this. Kyle Martino, to me, is a trailblazer because he has been able to shut up those critics who automatically tune out when they hear an American accent speak about their league. And let me say not their league, because most of these people are actually Americans who have developed some sort of snobbishness towards commentary and commentators. So Kyle Martino has gone from what is this token Yank doing on the broadcast of NBC to being, you know, that guy's a really good analyst. That guy knows soccer. He understands this league. He understands the culture of football. He understands the fan culture. So to me, he's a trailblazer because he is the first American commentator that's been able to commentate on a European league, and specifically the Premier League, the most popular European league in this country, and silence the critics who will have said in 2013 when NBC put him on the air, hey, this guy only played in MLS. This guy played college soccer at Virginia. This guy is not a – what would he know about Europe? What would he know about English football? So I think he's a very appealing candidate for a lot of people because he does have that ability to listen and that deafness, that political deafness. He's a very outspoken person, I think, on certain soccer issues, as we've seen on NBC. He's been very critical at times of Jose Mourinho and Arsene Wenger and other leading figures in the game with his analysis on NBC and also politically. I think anyone who follows Kyle Martino knows what his political allegiances are. They tend to mirror mine. This isn't a partisan political position, but I think that a lot of There tends to be more of a lean to the left among American soccer supporters, so I think they appreciate Martino's willingness to speak out on contemporary issues of the day, political issues, things like Colin Kaepernick also. You know, he's spoken out on that. So I think he's a very strong candidate. Now, the only issue is that he doesn't have a built-in constituency, right? We've talked about the built-in constituency for Kathy Carter. We talked about the built-in constituency potentially for Carlos Cordero. We talked about the built-in constituency, which are already manifesting themselves in terms of public endorsements for Quinalda. Now, where does Martino come in? Where is his support going to come from? I'm not sure when you talk about the very kind of narrow structure of how U.S. soccer elections are determined. But I think if you threw it open to the fans, he might very well win, and he might very well be the most responsible guy. I mean, I've talked to people who've met with him since he jumped in, who work in the game, and have told me he listens, one. He's very articulate about his views, but is open to their ideas and open to making his views evolve based on all the information he's getting. And that also he has a strong dislike for Sunil Gulati and the arbitrary decision-making that Sunil has undertaken, which has been, I guess, the theme of this entire show. So I think he changed a lot of things. He to me, is a very appealing candidate. But I'm not sure where the constituency in the very narrow scope of who votes on these things is for him. But we have a couple months, and my feeling is that he has maybe the greatest public recognition of candidates among the younger generation, as you mentioned. I think he that younger generation is also a generation that's very much in tune with watching the Premier League on Saturday and Sundays and not really watching MLS, but watching the national team and not really being aware of half the players in the national team because they don't play, they don't watch Major League Soccer. Martino has a connection with that fan base, and that might be the fan base that eventually controls the game in this country. So maybe if you're a voter in the U.S. soccer election, you say, hey, maybe we should make our bet now. We should make our deal now and elevate this guy because he certainly has both the gravitas and the backing of the grassroots and the people who engage in the sport in this country on a daily basis for us going forward. So that's him. I think he's got a much more difficult path to actually winning this thing, but might, if you looked at the public at large, have the most support.
Guys, thank you so much for joining me today. Andre, this morning, thank you very much as well. You're on the West Coast, Kartik as well on the East Coast. Hopefully the right person will take over, but obviously being eliminated from the World Cup qualifying down in Trinidad will remain Sunil Gulati's legacy to finish off. But thank you guys so much, and hope to talk to you guys next time. And if not, I'll talk to you guys in the new year. Take care now.
Thank you.
You too. Take care, Daniel.
Thank you very much. And that is Kartik Krishnayer of World Soccer Talk and Andrea Canales, soccer writer here in the country, in the United States. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, always wait for the archive as we get ready to see what's going to happen. The future, I don't know if it's bright or bleak. We'll have to wait and see what's going to happen. But right now, Sunil Gulati will not seek re-election as president of U.S. Soccer. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening to me this afternoon, or if you're on the West Coast this morning. And talk to you guys on Tuesday night after MLS Cup Final. Bye-bye for now. Enjoy your football.